be doing a children's story this morning. So we can go right ahead and bring Rick Kite up to, he came in with no papers in his hand, just like Bob Reddick did last week. So I panicked last week, but I didn't panic today because Bob made it through without an interruption too. So Rick, thank you and welcome.
And I've got papers.
Oh, there they are.
I'm one of these college professors that typically over-prepares and then gets through 10% of my material. If I do that today, I've got some notes that I'm happy to share with you if you want to know more of what I intended to say, because I never know what I'm actually going to end up talking about. Thank you so much, first of all, for inviting me to speak with you on the fifth principle. Let me read it again, because it's the more I've reflected on it, the more I find it really both remarkably insightful, but also significant for the time that we're living in right now. That is, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. This linking of conscience with the democratic process. First of all, that's a remarkable insight, and it has ancient origins. And secondly, that process should be respected not just in the congregation, but in society at large. And I want to say a few words at the end about that. And so I'd like to address three questions. First of all, the question, what is conscience? That's the obvious one. Secondly, how is it cultivated? Because it turns out that there's a lot of, I think, mistaken or kind of superficial ideas of conscience that can get us into trouble. And so how we cultivate it is very important. And then thirdly, how is conscience related to democracy? And that's kind of the crucial thing for our times and points to the really significant role I think the Unitarian Universalists can have within our society right now. We all know that conscience is that voice inside our heads that tells us what's right and what's wrong. Some of you remember like the old movies or the old cartoons with the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other, which also, by the way, represents the difficulty of knowing which voice it is that you should be listening to, because most of us have lots of voices in our heads, and sometimes we listen to the wrong one. So the voice that I hear just about every evening is the voice that's telling me, go ahead and eat ice cream just before going to bed, because it won't cause me indigestion this time as it has every other time in the last 20 years. And besides, it won't cause any weight gain because I can always do more steps the next day. Like this sort of rationalization that comes to us, I mean, on a regular basis, oftentimes about trivial things, it's hard to keep straight. When do we listen to ourselves and when don't we? Right? And it turns out listening to ourselves in the right way is even harder than figuring out what other people we should be listening to. But this has a, this actually is quite a deep concern. I think many of you probably have read at some point The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And there's a famous passage in that story in which Huck and his friend Jim, who's an escaped slave, are going down the river in a raft. And there is a group of men coming down the river looking for Jim. And Huck sees them. Huck and Jim both see them. It's at night. And they call out to the raft who they're looking for. Jim trusts that Huck is not going to turn him in. But Huck thinks that would be the right thing to do because he, as he explains in the story, he's thinking Jim is somebody's property and he has run away against the law, and the honest thing for him to do would be to report Jim. And so Jim takes off, Huck takes off in a canoe leaving the raft to go tell them, and he's determined he's going to tell them the truth, thinking this is what his conscience is telling him he has to do. This is the right thing to turn Jim in. But he gets there and he just can't do that. And he says, all the spunk just went out of me. And he determines after that he's not going to listen to conscience anymore, but to do whatever seems to him right at the time. Okay. Well, we're reading this. It's a remarkable passage because we're thinking, well, that's a good thing that he didn't follow his conscience. And yet he did follow some kind of guidance. Like he followed the guidance of friendship. Like, and this is another kind of voice. Well, it turns out, as we see, like this idea of friendship and how friendship informs the way we see the world is central to the formation of conscience. There's other, even more insidious and real-life examples of what we sometimes call an errant conscience or a falsely formed conscience. And one example comes from the record we have of certain speeches given by Heinrich Himmler, who was head of the SS. There's a famous speech in which he was speaking to the SS generals about their role in genocide, in the extermination of the Jews. And he says in this speech to his generals that the SS had managed to wipe out the Jews, quote, without our leaders and their men suffering any damage in their minds and souls. The danger was considerable, for there was only a narrow path between becoming heartless ruffians unable any longer to treasure life and becoming soft and suffering nervous breakdowns. He said that, so like they had managed, he said, to carve out this narrow path of duty. And then he said later in an interview, he said, it is the curse of greatness that it must step over dead bodies to create new life. Yet we must cleanse the soil or it will never bear fruit. It will be a great burden for me to bear. And we see echoes of these kinds of justifications for killing civilians going on right now today. And you have to think, well, what has gone on in the formation of conscience that we have people that not only speak openly but with like great pride and conviction of the necessity of killing civilians in order to obtain some political ends that they perceive as good. And I think it's like this, whenever we see this happening, it's an evidence of the faulty formation of conscience. And so it's really important to do this. So to see that conscience is more than just the voice of right and wrong inside our heads, like it can't be just that. It must be a certain kind of voice that's developed in the right way and that guides us correctly. And so we need to look a little more closely at, well, how is it cultivated? How is a proper conscience cultivated? And for that, there's actually some really good cues in the very word itself. If we look at the etymology of the word conscience, it comes from the two Latin words con, which means together, and scientia, which is the Latin word for knowledge. So how do we know together? And the ancients thought that, and mainly some of the Romans, but mainly the ancient Greeks, thought that there were two primary ways that we know together. One way to think of this is, how do we develop knowledge with God? That is, how do we become receptive to divine inspiration? Knowing that, like as human beings, we always favor our own interests, and we're very subject to self-deception. We can talk ourselves into justifying our own interests, and when we get together, we make it even worse. And we find out really good evidence of this. There's something called the law of group polarization, that the more you get people like or like-minded together, the more extreme they become in their views, right? So that. Like one of the ways to get us out of this kind of confirming our self-interest is by getting us to speak with people who disagree with us. But there's also this idea that comes from the Greeks of like the making room for the voice of God within our organizations and within society. So the Athenians, for example, and many of the other Greek city-states, they would go to the oracle at Delphi to get guidance on certain crucial things. And like they needed an outside voice to give them another opinion. And we have this in many different kinds of religious traditions. There's the prophet or the seer, the oracle, and then there's the fool, right? The fool who is able to speak truthfully, but in a way that is kind of outside of the systems or the structures in which we organize all, like our political bodies and our systems of power. There's another way of interpreting this idea of knowing together, and this is knowing with our neighbor. This is, we sometimes call this sympathy. The moral sense theorist who the Scottish philosophers of the 18th century, people like David Hume and Adam Smith and Francis Hutcheson, they talked a great deal about cultivating fellow feeling. You know, Latin word for that was sympathy or compassion. This fellow feeling is the ability to imaginatively experience what another person is going through. And this only comes through a kind of, both first of all, an upbringing in which we are properly socialized to care about and understand a range of experience. And then the ongoing kind of participation in social life in a way in which we're regularly interacting with people, both friends and strangers, right? And I'll just a kind of a side note here. There's terms that were in Latin that made this really clear, how closely this is related to a certain kind of religious orientation in life that are lost to us now because the way that words have changed. But if we see that conscientia, this idea of knowing together, that this is the formation of conscience, is closely related to conversatio, which from which we get conversation. That means turning together. Like knowing together, from turning together in conversation, this is also the root of the word conversion. Like to have a religious conversion is to live in a way in which we love our neighbors, in which we are oriented to turn together. The Latin word for sin was aversio. That's living in a way in which we turn away from our neighbors, right? And so you find this throughout medieval writings lots of times. It's like sin was not the idea of breaking like church rules or violating dogma. It was living in a way in which you either hated or feared other people, or living in a way that caused people to hate or fear you. These are ways in which like you divide human beings, you put wedges in our lives. So both of these kind of stand out. And so it turns out if we reflect on these ideas of conscience as like turning together with God and turning together with our neighbors, we really need four things that I think we need. First of all, we need like what are the reliable sources from which we get some kind of idea of what does the divine expect from us? What is this idea that from where we get reliable access to that which is outside of our self-interest but turns us in the direction of the good or the true or the beautiful? And so some idea of like what counts as scripture, what counts as kind of some kind of readings that as a body we turn to together as kind of reliable guidance. The second thing is the habit of prayer or contemplation. because it's in the movement of prayer or contemplation that we open ourselves to the divine. So we let go of our will and our kind of narrowly considered interests, and we put ourselves in the mode of receptivity. Third is social structures that make room for voices of dissent. So social structures in which we welcome the voice of the outsider, and in which we say that our primary mode of engagement is questioning and listening instead of kind of mandating or providing some kind of agenda. What we find, first of all, is, well, work is not that kind of place, right? And home is not the place where we typically encounter others. So it can't be first place, which is home. It can't be second place, which is work. It has to be what sociologists call a third place. And third places are places like churches, coffee shops, and bars. Also parks, libraries, but any of the kinds of places where we gather together regularly with others, where the main focus of the activity is conversation. We need places like that to provide a kind of social structure for the ongoing, but like the, both the formation, but the ongoing maintenance of conscience. And then third, we have to commit ourselves to spending regular time in the company of others. And this is the one of the things that seems to me to be most deeply troubling about the current time in which we live, is that we've had electronic media and technologies developing to such an extent that we've developed this whole kind of social infrastructure, what we call social media, but other kinds of formation or other kinds of the gathering, mainly virtual gathering, in which it's very easy to both engage and disengage. That is the characteristic of it, but which don't require joining. They don't require commitment. And it is really hard to develop in oneself the kind of attitude of kind of turning together with others, a kind of engagement in which one stays with the engagement even when it becomes unpleasant, when you're primarily interacting with others in ways where it's very easy to engage and disengage. Because what we have now is a real decline in membership. People aren't joining the way they used to join. And then that's a problem, because it's in joining and making regular commitment that I will stick with a group, stay turning together towards a group, even when things happen that I don't want to, even when the conversations get difficult or it gets uncomfortable for me. And so I'll wrap up here. I want to say that, could I have a few more minutes? So how conscience is related to democracy. So the ancient Greeks, and this is especially the Athenians, like we get our idea of democracy from that. They're the first ones to articulate it. We find there may have been other forms of democracy, certain forms of democracy that were taking place without the kind of written record, but the first time we have any kind of written record of a group of people committing themselves to freedom and equality together, and so that like all citizens have representation in the major decisions on how they're going to live together. This comes from the Athenians. And the Athenians were really concerned about two things that would threaten this freedom. One was tyranny, like being captured by somebody from the outside, because, well, what happened in the ancient Greek world is what has happened in most of the world, for most of the world's history, that has conquered people become slaves. And slavery had been widely practiced up to that time. In fact, the first time we see any writings kind of openly questioning slavery are first of all in Plato, and then in the Stoics, it came just after Plato. And so you have this kind of questioning of this, something that had been kind of a universal practice throughout human history. And they had a great fear of this, like being taken over by a conquering people that would both threaten to make us literal slaves, but also change our culture, like dictate to us what our culture had to be. The other thing they really feared was chaos. They feared the loss of internal restraint that would allow us to come together and make and choose like a form of life and kind of a social structure that would allow us to continue it. They feared a loss of that, which would just kind of devolve into nothing, and so we wouldn't have any identity anymore as a people. And what happens when you lose that kind of identity, then you're sooner or later you are conquered, you are taken over by tyrants. And so they had a fear of these two things, like external powers gaining control, and then loss of internal power, because it's the internal restraint, it's the ability to govern ourselves, which allow us to operate with freedom and have a status of equality among others. And we see in the development of especially religious organizations in the centuries following the kind of development of democracy with the Athenians, we see kind of the birth of Christianity at the same time as the Roman Empire is gaining ascendancy. And then we see the Roman Catholic Church developing a structure in which they focused responsibilities for most of the really important moral and ethical questions in the authority of the church itself. And so even today, the Catholic Church carves out a role for conscience, but conscience isn't the main voice providing guidance on what is right and wrong. The church does that, and the church has its teachings, and that provides the main guidance. But there is a small role for conscience to speak out in opposition. There's a recognition that, well, once in a while, it's the voice of the outsider, and God might speak directly to the individual, like in opposition. And so there's this small role carved up for conscience within the Catholic Church. And then you have the Unitarians and the Quakers, who are on the other end of the spectrum saying, no, it's not that like conscience has this small role to speak out against authority. Conscience is the authority. And it's really only the Unitarians and the Quakers who give this primacy to conscience. And all of the other denominations, including the Methodists over there, fall somewhere in between the Catholics and the Unitarians. And by the way, and this is why the mainline churches continue to struggle with breaking apart, because if you don't have the ability to talk over crucial issues of what's right and wrong within our society, if you don't have the ability to talk that over and to make up your minds among groups of people who can actually disagree but still love one another within their disagreement, if you can't have that, then churches just become another branch of politics. And this is what has happened is, like, you know, you'll have, I'm Presbyterian right now, our General Assembly will come up with some announcements like, this is what all Presbyterians believe. And then, you know, and then you'll have a quarter of the Presbyterians say, well, then I guess I'm not Presbyterian, so they just leave, right? So then you pretty much, then before long, you have what's left is a group of people that share the same political views, right? And so churches lose their function in society. And so this is why I think this Unitarian principle of linking conscience and democracy, and then saying that it's not important just for our congregation here, it's important for society at large. Because we've increasingly become a society in which we have two kinds of influences on our lives, our personal self-interest, and then our political interests. And we haven't carved out sufficient places for where the individual can be receptive to something that we usually call inspiration or the voice of God or something like this, that can be felt quite deeply, and that is expressed naturally in the love we have for one another, and how that when we work this out, which is quite a messy process, it has to be worked out within groups in which we all have voices, right? And this was so foundational to the founding of the United States that Alexis de Tocqueville, when he visited here in the early 1800s, remarked that American democracy is just unique in the world and quite remarkable. He said, whenever citizens have some need that they recognize in their communities, they just get together in groups. They organize some club or association, these became known, and they just work it out among themselves. They don't petition the government, or they don't wait for somebody else to take care of the problem. They take care of the problems by self-organizing in groups. See, then this is this idea of, and he said, and this is how churches function, and this is how other kinds of clubs function, right? So churches as places where democracy flourishes in its proper form, this kind of is maintained by today by Unitarian principles in a way I think it's been abandoned by many other places. So thank you for the opportunity to reflect more deeply on this. I learned something that is quite significant about Unitarians. So I'm grateful to you, and I hope that it's something that helps you to think more deeply and more positively about your own tradition. So thank you.
Do we?
But science in its early understanding was scientia. This is
okay.
Knowledge.
Okay.
So the Greeks had these different understandings of knowledge. Scientia was this Latin word which we get comes from two Greek notions, episteme, which is kind of what we often call not scientific knowledge. This is like, what do you know, what are the facts, what are things, and then there's also sophia, which is wisdom. Okay, so wisdom comes more not just your knowledge of facts, but your understanding of them and their place in the human life. And their knowledge of conscience, like, you can learn facts on your own. You can study things, you can figure things out, and you can also be quite clever, right? But you only develop wisdom in the company of others. That requires conversation.
We'll see if it's done.